This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start with Professor Jennifer Nuzzo. Professor Nuzzo, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, she starts us off today because Professor Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center and a senior scholar at Hopkins Center for Health Security. And, you know, Professor Nuzzo, it's a little hard to believe, but the first time you were on our show here at On Point was way back in January of 2020, talking about this new thing called the coronavirus. I mean, it's hard to believe that all of this has been going on for more than a year, don't you think?
It is really hard. It feels like 5 years.
How are you and your kids doing?
We're hanging in there. We are lucky compared to so many people, but it's tough. My son's been out of school for about a year, and it's really wearing on him.
Okay. Well, so we wanted to invite you back because we felt like this is a moment to really talk about how we, being the media, policymakers, and experts, have been talking about COVID over this past long year. So, I mean, let's actually go back to March 2020, right? Because there was this basically short period of a couple of days in the middle of March where basically every school in the United States shut down. Was that the right move at that time?
Well, you know, I was quite critical of it at the time, not because I didn't think it was going to happen, but because I really worried that we were doing it without any understanding of the impacts that it was going to have. The fact that our kids, many of our kids are still not back in school, I think is a testament to the fact that we really didn't have a plan for how we were going to live in this pandemic and keep educating our children, keep feeding children, make sure that they, get the kind of services that they need, that schools are so important to provide. I think at that point, it was probably inevitable that it was going to happen, in part because I think there was just a lot of concern and uncertainty about the virus. I had felt that we could have done some safety measures then, but, I think it was inevitable, probably.
Right. Well, again, because we're talking about sort of how risk gets communicated, I think it's worth remembering that, it was that time, and actually before that time, in February, where there was all that news coming out of China about entire provinces of, 10, 11 million people being fully locked down and not really knowing how many people had died in China. And then, of course, cases were rising, particularly in places like New York City. I mean, people were nervous. They had reason to be scared, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, I think one of the reasons why that nervousness was so acute was because we were so deeply unprepared for the virus, despite the fact that, in March, we had already had a few months warning that it was coming to the U.S. and we would need to be ready. We weren't able to test many people. And I think that added to a lot of the uncertainty, just feeling like there was this kind of looming threat that we couldn't quite see.
Yeah. So in that March timeframe, as much as you can remember, evaluate how the communication from the media, from policymakers, from experts was. I mean, were people there was a confusion of information, but were people getting at least some of the kinds of information that would help them make good decisions?
I mean, I think so. I think it was largely the best that could be done at the time. I think the thing that I feel sort of regret about is that we didn't do a better job in March of communicating the protracted nature of this crisis and the fact that it was not going to be something that would disappear in a couple of weeks. I know when they closed our schools here, they initially announced it for 2 weeks and many parents were up in arms and they thought, oh gosh, how can we survive 2 weeks? And, I would tell other parents, it's not going to be 2 weeks. This is a long-term situation that we're going to have to deal with. And I don't feel like that aspect was communicated as clearly as it should have been.
Oh, interesting. I was just a few minutes ago, I was looking back and listening to the press conferences that happened literally in like six different cities on March 13th, 14th, and 15th. And they all say 2 week shutdown of schools. It feels like a completely different world, given that that was almost a year ago. I feel like public health officials felt compelled, in part because of the confusing messaging coming out of Washington, felt compelled to really like convince people that these were worthy actions, like that they should be scared, they should stay home, right?
Right, exactly. And I think some of that may be translated into a bit of chipper messaging, like, you know, stay home for 2 weeks, crush the curve. And, you know, there's, I think, a fine line between trying to encourage people to do things that were very much needed at that point, recognizing that it was going to be a hardship, but, you know, perhaps overselling the immediate impact that it would have. I mean, it was important. It needed to be done at that point, but it wasn't going to vanquish the virus. It wasn't going to make the virus go away. I'm not sure public health officials who are speaking even fully understood that, which I think is part of the problem. I mean, you know, I had a sense that this was going to be a long-term thing because I study pandemics, and I give a lot of thought, you know, 40, 60, 80 hours a week about these issues. But public health officials who are on the front lines in government, they're dealing with any number of problems. And, you know, they maybe a pandemic plan wasn't the top of the things that they had been familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I just want to reiterate to folks listening that this is actually not an hour about schools. We will be doing a full hour, in fact, multiple hours about school reopening in the coming days and weeks. It's just that schools are such a perfect example about how we have been talking and communicating about risks regarding this pandemic. So, you know, as we go to April, May, June of 2020, do you think that the messaging around what we were learning about COVID risks in schools, what we were learning about children and transmissions, do you think that was well communicated to people?
You know, I think it was communicated, but the problem with the school issue is that the risks of the virus and the benefits of school are not shared by the same people. And that's a really challenging situation because when we think about returning to schools, you know, we can talk about, you know, that children have been relatively, I won't say spared the effects of this virus, but fortunately they have not borne the brunt of it like other older age individuals. But we do, of course, worry about the safety of the staff, particularly older staff, particularly staff who may have underlying health conditions. So when you talk about the urgency of returning to school, I mean, really the benefits are for children who very much need those in-person you know, education and services. But when you're talking about the worries about being there, it's really for the staff. And so I think that's created a bit of a challenging situation to communicate because you're talking to two totally different populations.
Do you think one of those populations is listening? I mean, you wrote an op-ed, you co-wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on July 1st of 2020 saying, you know, don't worry about bars and restaurants and gyms. Like, here's what we need to do to reopen schools. Did that move? Did it move? I know you did a lot of media again in July because you did, but did it move the needle at all?
You know, so that op-ed was really saying, listen, you know, we need to open schools. And if the fastest way to do that is to bring our case numbers down, is it strictly necessary? No, but the fastest, safest, easiest way around is to bring our case numbers down. So let's focus on the places that are the greatest risk for spreading the virus. And those are things like bars and restaurants. I think that comparison has been used quite heavily since, you know, we made those points and we weren't the only ones then to do it. There was a few other op-eds that came out very, you know, closely timed that said that same argument. So we hear people say, you know, close the restaurants and bars, open the schools. CDC has since said that, you know, schools should be the last to close and the first to open. Unfortunately, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that communities have taken that approach. And, you know, again, where I live, they've opened everything else before our schools. They've even opened hookah bars, which in a pandemic seems like a particularly risky place to be.
You know, this is a complex issue, and I do not wish to oversimplify. But still, we sort of have to find ways through this conversation because I at the same time I'm hearing still to this day, and seeing on message boards, etc., that some of the resistance to opening schools up. In the, you know, where they're not currently open in the United States it's couched in the language of profound fear, you know, like teachers saying you're going to have blood on your hands or saying like the death of one child is going to be on your conscience, school committee. I mean, people are still very scared.
They are. And I don't dismiss that fear. I mean, that fear, I think, is an important thing that we have to deal with and act upon, because as much as I very much want my children to go to school, I know that the benefit of their being there is only contingent on their teachers feeling comfortable being there. I mean, you know, the benefit of seeing the online learning is really getting to witness the magic that is teaching. Mm-hmm. And I know that magic can't be there if my son's teacher feels like she's there under duress.
Right. But
so we have to deal with that.
So, Professor Noza,
sure.
I've got to ask you, though. I mean, this is why the risk communication and understanding risk is the key of here. Feeling safe, feeling, right? I mean, I'm not sure how we can make people feel safe when there's no such thing as a world of zero risk, right? A couple of months ago in ProPublica and The New Yorker, there was a really great article about the challenges, complex challenges around reopening school. And there was this one paragraph I want to read to you. You were quoted in it, right? It said, public health officials who had spent months scaring people into taking proper precautions were now struggling to unscare them enough to contemplate a return to school. The messaging never evolved, said Jennifer Nuzzo.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a challenge. But in terms of feeling safe, I mean, it's not just like some irrational emotion that people are experiencing. It's partially their judgment of the safety of the situation. And it's not purely just, you know, this is a safe environment and you're just not understanding that. It's also the fact that perhaps they don't feel comfortable in the approaches that have been taken. I mean, I will tell you, when asked, you know, about sending our children back to hybrid learning, I asked his teacher how she felt about it. And she said that no one had ever actually asked her. And I think that's part of the problem. We need to give people a role in developing these safety protocols so that they do feel confident in them and that they do feel like their concerns have been addressed.
Okay. Well, this hour we are talking about communicating, understanding risk over the course of this pandemic, and whether that be the media, policymakers, experts, have been doing that in the right way and the way that's most useful to everyone. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this hour we're talking about communicating and understanding risk, especially regarding the COVID pandemic, and whether or not that communication has been done in the right, best, and most useful way for all of you. I mean, for example, let's hear a couple of different polls in terms of how risk gets communicated. Here is former President Trump's coronavirus advisor, Scott Atlas, on a San Diego news station last October 2020, railing against coronavirus messaging in the media.
The people that believe that you should just continue lockdowns are literally killing people. The people that are implying that the infection is highly dangerous for everyone are killing people because they're instilling fear and paralyzing society.
Scott Atlas in October. And here's Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti a couple of months later in December of 2020, speaking as infections in LA County began to soar.
My message couldn't be simpler. It's time to hunker down. It's time to cancel everything. If you're able to stay home, stay home.
So just a couple of months apart in two Southern California communities there, different types of messages. I'm joined today by Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center. And also joining us now is Zeynep Tufekci, professor at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Information. She's also a columnist for The Atlantic, and she runs a newsletter as well called Insight. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, one of the earliest goals amongst public health experts in March of 2020 was goals of the lockdowns were essentially to keep hospital systems from being overwhelmed. That was the first message we got from Ashish Jha on Point in March. That's different than eradicating a pandemic. Do you think that it was ever clear to the public what the early goals were, Zainab?
I think it was and was not. It wasn't clear enough for sure. The flatten the curve message was absolutely important because at the time we were facing a crisis, so we could have communicated better. But I'm just looking at, like, now that it's kind of anniversaries, I've been looking at the outdoor situation because we're still closing parks. And just sort of to refresh my memory, I look back at an article I wrote the first week of April for The Atlantic where I try to say we can't keep closing parks and outdoors because this pandemic isn't going away in a few weeks. We'll be maybe social distancing on and off for another year, and we need to figure out how to maintain compliance with better targeting of these measures. And I remember at the time, the idea that we'd be doing this for another year, people just came to me and said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, it's a pandemic. It's not going away tomorrow. So there was this feeling, as you were talking with Dr. Noza, that, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and then what? Right? I think we didn't get that then what message properly targeted, but it's understandable. You know, you're kind of in a panic. You don't really have clarity. But what I think we failed to do to this day, unfortunately, is to adjust our messaging to our understanding of the risk. For example, you just talked about the Los Angeles mayor talking about staying home. For one thing, it's not clear that it's the people who can choose to stay home that's the problem. A lot of the spread is in workplaces. Right. So just stay home doesn't really help with it. Something like better masks for people who can't stay at home would be better targeted. And we're still seeing, you know, a year into this, doing things like stay home and closing the parks when, in fact, one, outdoors is crucial. This is a pandemic driven by super spreading and over dispersion, and those always occur indoors. So that's another thing. Telling people to stay home if they live in a crowded apartment with bad ventilation, that's probably not good. In fact, we have new polling that shows that people who live in multi-generational housing where they're crowded are more likely to catch COVID. So maybe staying home really wasn't the good message. Not everybody can stay home. Outdoors is good for us. And there's all these other ways in which we haven't really evolved our messaging. And we're just saying, wear a mask, stay home, wear a mask, stay home. Without, like, it's not what we should be doing this late in a pandemic.
Yeah. You know, I remember a while ago, actually, it wasn't that long ago, but a couple of months ago, you also put out a Twitter thread saying, you know, because people were like, were shaming folks for going to the beach. Right. Yeah. And you were like, we have to stop this beach shaming or this outdoor shaming. But I do wonder, isn't there a concern amongst experts? And I'll actually let Professor Noza chime in here. But that because, you know, the sort of give people an inch, they'll take a mile kind of thing. So the messaging did feel like it had to be kind of absolutist for a while.
So what you just said, give people an inch and they'll take a mile, is absolutely going to, like, backfire. I know you're not claiming this, but what you need to do is exactly the opposite. Because if you do that, if you don't trust people with the correct information, they won't trust you back. And there's nothing more important in public health communication than having people's trust. The problem with the beach communication was it was full of pictures of people in breezy beaches, clearly probably the safest place you could be in a pandemic. And nobody in a bikini goes right next to a stranger, like, and just coughs in their face. This is not, like, I couldn't even understand what the threat was. If they mean to say, stay away from the indoor restaurants that may accompany a beach trip, that's what we should say, because then we really lose trust, because we act like we're just trying to sort of get compliance by scaring people. And we're not talking about toddlers. We're talking about adults. So this kind of, you know, give an inch, they'll take a mile. Not only does it not work because it's not properly targeted, it backfires, because then when we do say something, don't do this, they're kind of like, can we trust you? Are you just trying to scare me? Or are you telling me the correct information? So what we needed to do from the beginning was to be more precise and more targeted. I don't mean false hope. I don't mean false certainty. I don't mean fear either. Just like, this is what we know is risky, and this is why, which empowers people. If they're in a new environment and they're looking and thinking, should I go into that store? They should be able to think, it's crowded. Maybe not right now. Like,
well, let me get Professor Nuzzo to chime in here. What's your reaction to what Zeynep Tufekci is saying?
Oh, I completely agree. I've been nodding very vigorously. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, people are trying to do the right thing for themselves and their families, and they have to, you know, take actions to meet their needs. And just telling them continually, no, 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 I mean, that doesn't leave people with many options. You know, maybe that works for a few weeks. Maybe that fear can you know, prevent them from doing things for a few weeks. But after a while, people are just going to look for ways to live their lives. And we have to do a better job of telling people how to live their lives safely instead of telling them everything that they can't do.
It does seem, and Zeynep, I'll turn to you for this, that is there a presumption? Okay, let me back up here, actually, because we're talking about different information coming from different places, politicians, public health or scientific officials and experts, the media, and different kinds of information, whether it be official pronouncements, actual policies, stuff that's floating around on the web. I'm trying to actually hold this all in my brain as kind of a dynamic matrix here. But do you think that there's this a presumption, at least from, let's say, politicians and experts, those two categories, that people couldn't handle or can't handle the kind of complex, variegated, empowering information that you're talking about, that they felt like they needed to simplify the message?
Well, I think it's just the wrong approach. That does happen. Like, I do know that sometimes sort of simplifying the message is seen as being more effective, but it just backfires, as I said, especially if the simplification is incorrect, as in the whole, you know, beach shaming episode. That's still not over. I'm still seeing people being shamed for just being outdoors, which makes in media sometimes. And, you know, once again, you need to give people the right intuition about how this virus transmits, because like in the beginning, like the first month for me, like January, February, where we had less information, I think it made sense to just be extra cautious with everything. There's no question, because there's this, we don't know the fatality rate for sure. We don't know if fomites, like contacting and touching things, is a big risk. So at first it makes sense, but as we learn, we need to adjust the messaging. To go back to the schools, a lot of schools, like in my local area, when they reopen, they haven't reopened. When they reopen, they're planning to keep a whole day off for deep cleaning, quote unquote. When a year in, we know that's absolutely unnecessary. Like they'll be starting their cleaning 12 hours after anyone has been in the building. They're going to keep the kids away from school. So I'm not saying they should open or not open, but when they do, you know, after kids have missed so much, it makes no sense to deep clean a whole day. If it's safe to open, it's safe to open. We don't need to deep clean. If it's not safe to open, the deep cleaning is just, you know, pandemic theater. It's hygiene theater. It does not make sense. So there's a lot of these things that have not been communicated properly that are still affecting policy. We haven't communicated the aerosol airborne transmission risk properly. To this day, I'm contacted by people, because I wrote an article about it in the summer, who tell me that they're not allowed to just open windows in their workplace because the airborne transmission has not been communicated properly. Those are the kind of things where hopefully now, because last year, we all know kind of the CDC was greatly hampered. I'm really hoping that the CDC and the public health authorities nationally will step up and cut through this confusion, because it's harming our response.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting because a couple of quick things. One is having a more complex set of guidelines that acknowledge the evolution of understanding, the evolution of our science's knowledge about the pandemic, then giving people sort of different options of strategies. I mean, back in May, of 2020, we did a show about, you know, is it time to think about the pandemic through the lens of a harm reduction strategy rather than a zero risk strategy? And we got very angry responses from people saying, how dare you talk about it in this way? We have to beat the pandemic entirely. I mean, so I do wonder if we need to discuss for a second the difference between communicating what real risks are and communicating what our real knowledge is versus people's perception of that risk, okay? And so in order to do that, let's just listen to a little bit from what we heard from a listener who called us from Vermont. And he actually says the media should have been able to get the message out better on how to stay safe or safer in the pandemic.
It is a double-edged sword. If you get the public completely educated, the economy shuts down. But anyone with a high school education can understand the process if it's explained to the public properly about viral loads, when to get tested, how it works, when you are contagious. So the long of the short, no, we're not getting educated by the news media outlets.
Well, joining us now is David Ropeek. He's an expert on risk communication and the psychology of risk perception, author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts, and co-author of Risk, A Practical Guide for Deciding What's Really Safe and What's Really Dangerous in the World Around You. David Ropeek, welcome.
Meghna, hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's just focus on the media here for a second, and you know, including yours truly. Your evaluation on how the risk communication has been going on in the media?
A brief bit of background. I was a TV reporter in Boston for 25 years, and mea culpa about what I'm about to say. The media is in the business of getting people's attention. It is not school. It is not, as the Vermont caller said, the educator. That simply misunderstands the culture of what the news media is. Would that that were not so, but that's so. So getting attention means stories. Getting attention means drama. Getting attention means conflict. That's why politics is covered as a battle as opposed to the policy the politics is about. And when a new risk comes along, new is scarier to all of us because psychologically we don't know what we need to know to protect ourselves. And that's a feeling of powerlessness. That's, by the way, why we do things to give ourselves a sense of control, like buy toilet paper or guns. Gas masks after 911 and the anthrax letters. So new instinctively is more attention getting and going to get played up, as is the scary part, by the media. And I have good friends who are very responsible, highly thought of science journalists who just could not report enough or tweet enough about the scary parts of this. I remember asking early on a couple of them, why isn't anybody reporting the survival rate too?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just not part of the culture of the media. And that's frustrating to a lot of people, but it needs to be understood.
Well, so
on the other hand,
David, let me just jump in here.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
And I definitely want to hear from Jennifer and Zeynep about this too. But I'll use myself as an example. You know, we've been covering this for a year, and I think I'm not proud of this, but I think I can probably count on one, maybe a couple of fingers on the other hand, how many times in that year I have said, you know, the current number of deaths is X, but the number of people who have, you know, survived is Y.
That's my point.
Right? I mean, like, you get sucked into that trap. But also not to say that just simply surviving COVID means that you're like out of the woods, right? Because that's a complex story too. But it feels almost impossible not to get sucked into that narrower band of here's why you should be concerned.
Well, I would put it to you this way, and this is how I thought it through when I was in the media and now when I do commentary and so forth. We do have a responsibility to the people we're informing to not inform them in a way that will do harm. The media do have basic rules about not doing bomb scares and not covering suicides and things where reporting on it will cause harm. This is the same. This really is the same. If we report, and I say we in the commentariat and doctors, professors, Nzozo would Tufekci are part of this. If we report on things in a way that disproportionately weighs on people's fears, which is instinctive for the media and part of their business model, okay, mm-hmm. we do harm. There is a responsibility to step back and think about that and take yeah. that seriously. When you, Meghna, and your producers make choices about what shows to do and what to say during conversation mm-hmm. and what the headlines are in papers and on news sites and so forth, that's part of the responsibility yep. that I, for years, have encouraged the media to think about.
Well, David, I've got to just take a quick break here. So we'll do that and we'll come right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we're talking about how the risks of the COVID pandemic have been communicated to you over the past year from experts, from policymakers, from the media, and what that means about the decisions that people have been making and whether or not you've been getting the kind of information that you need. We've got a lot of responses coming in online. Niels Holland says, from the very beginning, Dr. Fauci was exceedingly clear, indicating a successful strategy had to be that of overreaction. The prior administration did great harm to that strategy with its downplayed messaging. The new administration's support of science is welcome and life-saving. And for example, we've also got this saying, I'm not going to tag all the folks I've had disagreements with for months now since December who didn't believe me that our bungled messaging on post-vaccine transmission was fueling vaccine hesitancy. How many examples have we heard now? I hear this every single day. I'm joined today by David Ropeek, Jennifer Nuzzo, and Zeynep Tufekci. And Professor Nuzzo, I know I've got to let you go here in a minute, so I wanted to just give you one last say. We were talking about the media's role in accurately, or actually the role that the media played in not as fully accurately as it could have, portraying the risks of the pandemic. And I wanted to know what your response was that, especially after having done so many interviews like this one over the past year. What do you think?
I think I actually take a different approach on this. I mean, you know, the media is the deliverer of the message. I think the problem is that we didn't actually craft the right messages to deliver. I've been involved in so many conversations with media where I really have felt that they've been kind of active partners in getting the message out and also pushing back on perhaps some of the misleading messaging that government officials were doing. You know, I think they really helped to try to, you know, get some truth out there, given the fact that there were leaders who were just kind of openly questioning the existence of the virus and the need to take it seriously. The problem is, it is hard to message about what things people should do. And you know, I think your whole point earlier about the pushback that you got from the harm reduction show, this idea that you're going to acknowledge that some people may not fully follow public health guidance. And if that's going to happen, what can they do to make it safer safer given what they're about to do anyway. I think that's a very reasonable approach, and it's one that certain fields in public health have learned as a result of decades of experience in terms of dealing with things like drug use and sexually transmitted infections. And we should very much incorporate that into other public health messaging. Unfortunately, I just don't feel like a lot of the messages that have come out from governments have been, they've been slow to take that harm reduction approach in how they talk about this virus and what we should be doing about it to protect ourselves.
Well, Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center. Professor Nuzzo, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Zainab Tufekci, you were talking earlier about the kinds of information that you see people needing that they haven't been getting. But, David Ropeik before the break was outlining pretty clearly why, at least through the media, because, that kind of complex information doesn't keep eyeballs on screens or keep ratings high. I mean, are the vehicles by which we have to spread information operating in opposition to the kinds of good information that we do need to get out there?
Well, yes, definitely. But I also agree with Dr. Nuzzo there that the public health officials and authorities and experts should do better to direct the media as well. So it's like a multi-part thing where, for example, I'll give you a wrong thing to do. When there was a single allergic reaction, the New York Times app pushed a notification to everybody's screen saying there was an allergic reaction. Now, that's the kind of thing that's just, I think, attention grabbing and really misplaced, because while side effects like that do happen, they're extremely rare. And in that particular case, it was handled. She was, just taken care of. It wasn't even some tragic outcome. But what you see is, instead of the message that we have these amazing vaccines, you're just hearing about the side effects first. That's not saying don't talk about the side effects. We should tell people about it, but we bombarding them like that first, rather than the balanced approach, which is to talk about how great the vaccines are and their actual benefits, is just going to make people more hesitant. So that's a media problem. But there's also a public health authority and official problem, in that what I'm hearing a lot, and I'm hoping the CDC will change that soon, is currently the message is nothing will change after vaccination. I'm just simplifying this a little bit and paraphrasing, but that's the impression we're giving. And that is not the correct impression. Of course, we don't want to just tell people to stop being careful just because they're vaccinated. But also, of course, the vaccinations will change what we can do over time, especially as we get more data. So just from even when the vaccines first started coming out, the very first week, there were so many articles on don't take your mask off, as if, there was some constituency trying to go wild immediately. There was an article titled, "You Can't Party Like It's 1999. I was like, why are we talking about this? We just started. We barely have anybody vaccinated. It's mostly healthcare workers anyway. They're not some uninformed group. And we have a zillion articles on what you can't do right after being vaccinated, as if that's a message we must repeat, which goes back to that idea, which is if we give people an inch, they'll take a mile, rather than the correct thing, which is you will get your life back eventually. These vaccines are great. Here's what we know. And yes, we're not changing policy immediately because we're waiting for more information. But no, we do not need 50 different headlines on what you can't do. It's You see what I'm saying? It's not that the message is wrong, but it's imbalanced.
Yeah. Okay. So David Ropeik, let me turn back to you here. I actually want to step back a couple of months and acknowledge something that we also had on top of a historic pandemic that we hadn't seen something like this for a century, a virus that was new to science, a modern world that's completely different than it was in 1918, 1919. I mean, there was the novel nature of this past year's experience was enough, right? That was enough complexity. But But then on top of that, we had the chaos of the leadership from the Trump administration, right? I mean, we had a literal, like, uncontrollable chaos when the former president would stand at the podium and say, you know, put UV lights down your throat or inject bleach. So the sense that it was even possible to somehow discern what a more reliable stream of information might be, as Zeynep is pointing out that we should have had, I mean, did that all go out the window given that federal level chaos? I mean, how was the media supposed to manage that in the right way?
Well, if I can, Meghna, let me step back from your question, reply to it, but then step back. Obviously, the federal response was led by somebody who's put his self-interest above the interest of others. And Zeynep said earlier the importance of trust. I can't stress that enough. When we're looking to our leaders, we need to trust that they're on our side. When we look to our friends, we need to trust that they're on our side to help keep us safe. That's an instinct for the human animal, the social human animal. And when we sense that we can't trust them, that blows everything apart. But let me step way back. Risk communication, not just the media, if I may. Mm-hmm. Risk communication is a specific tool of risk and public health safety management. When people's behaviors are part of what is going to make a risk worse or better, whether it's an epidemic or after 911 or anything, crisis or not crisis, drunk driving, cigarette smoking, when people's behaviors are part of what makes the risk better or worse, it is part of what public health needs to, and this sounds crude, but manage. You're trying to encourage healthier choices. Risk communication is a specific practice. It's not PR. It's not just the messages. Right. In fact, it's much more what you do than what you say. It is what you do and say that demonstrates an understanding of and a true, sincere respect for how people feel, because they're going to make their own choices no matter how good your information is in the context of their own lives. And its goal is to increase trust, which will increase the influence of the communicator to encourage healthy choices. Now, we had epidemics, pandemics, in the last decade. Nothing like this, but we knew it was coming. Did we have a risk communication plan for this? Did we have an infrastructure? Did we have messaging? Did we have actions? Did we have websites? Did we have misinformation, knockdown sorts of things? To the best I can tell, no. Mm-hmm. That's a super big failing and continues to be, in my opinion. Risk communication as a specific practice, and I'm not talking just PR, I'm talking about understanding the underlying psychology of why people make the choices they do and demonstrating a respect for that.
Yeah.
The way Andrew Cuomo did and Amy Acton did in Ohio, the director of public health and others, that will influence people's choices and manage the public health crisis better. And starting from that, we can get to all the particulars that you talked about and others, the guests have talked about.
Yeah. Okay. So we're sort of headed towards the last 5 minutes of the show here. Professor Tufekci, you know, both of you now, you and David, have sounded this note of like, really, we need to give good, accurate information that helps empower people, right? So what would you change now? What would you change to help us get closer to an information environment where that happens?
So my first wish is, and it's kind of started, we need like daily briefings from the public health authorities. And they need to sort of give us the picture. So what I look at right now is that there is this tension between the current kind of grim moment, right? We have these new variants that are more transmissible. Mm-hmm. We had a surge that we're just barely starting to get under control, and it's still very high. Seasonality is working against us. So we do need people to be more strict for the moment. So that's definitely part of the problem. But that needs to be balanced with the realization, one, people are tired. Quarantine fatigue is real. And they need to understand what's the end game. And this is just very honest. The end game is looking better and better. We have amazing vaccines. Their efficacy is very high. They're very effective against the outcomes we care about, like hospitalization and death. We're already planning for boosters for these variants. There's all these really, really hopeful things that we're nearing the end of this. We're going to have better things happen soon. We're slowly going to come out. And I think that needs to be communicated. And I feel like there's a fear that if we focus on that part, we will lose the message that we do need to be more strict for the moment. I think, in fact, the hope, the end game, the positive stuff, and realistically, I'm not talking at all ever about exaggerating or kind of misleading the public with things we are not sure about. It's just what we do know and what we think will happen. We can communicate that just explicitly. And I think that will help with compliance because if we know what's happening, we can better bear the moment. The second thing I would really like is to stop giving these like binary instructions we've been doing, like 6 feet, this, that, and the other, and explain the mechanisms, aerosol and airborne transmission. Fomites like are not that big a deal, but it makes sense to wash your hands. It makes sense to disinfect high touch surfaces, but you know, you don't need to really make a big show out of it. It's indoors. That's the problem. It's ventilation that really helps. So giving people that kind of intuition about the transmission mechanisms rather than rules that never work, like 6 feet or not distinguishing indoors and outdoors, disempowers people. Mm. Like we explain better masks and why and when. Mm-hmm. Like if you're walking your dog, no, you don't need an N95. If you're in a high-risk environment, this is why it might make sense and how to get it. You know, this kind of people, as Dr. Nuzzo was saying, people are looking to be safe.
That's right.
We need to empower them.
So you can't see me nodding my head vigorously because when you said the word binary, you took the words right out of my mouth. And David, we've just got about a minute and a half left here, so I'll let you have the last say. There does seem to be this sort of cultural presumption from the media, from, you know, risk communicators, experts, et cetera, that people either can or can't handle complex information. It is very binary. It is very black and white. And in a sense, it's very infantilizing of the American public. Do you think that we can undo the forces that have led to that perception from you know, folks like us in the media?
It's interesting that risk communication during a crisis and a pandemic like this, I'm going to talk largely from our government leaders who we look to protect ourselves from what we can't protect ourselves from as individuals. Let's forget all of what we learned as kids, which is pay attention to the other person's feeling when you're having a conversation with them. You asked a good question. How can we get to a communication environment that helps? We've talked a lot about specific messages. All of that will grow out of starting with treating people like we would treat them as people, not subjects, not taxpayers, not voters, getting back to understanding why they feel the way they do. And there is no one message. That's ridiculous, mm-hmm. of course, as Professor Nuzzo says at the beginning with schools, right? Teachers versus kids. Respecting them as people and then tailoring the messages, plural, and the actions so that they are responsive to how people feel about things. That's going to lead to healthier choices.
Well, David Ropeik is author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. He's an expert on risk communication and perception. Thank you so much, David, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Zeynep Tufekci, professor at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Information, columnist for The Atlantic, writes the newsletter Insight. Professor Tufekci, promise me you'll come back and talk with me for an hour about systems thinking too, okay?
I will absolutely be delighted to do that. Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.